Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Monsters Among Us. And in this episode, we're going to be talking about someone who lived not even 35 minutes away from where I'm sitting. And we're going to talk about how he terrorized the gay community in Indianapolis, Indiana, and along I-70. We're talking about Herb Baumeister. I'm gonna start this story in a little bit of an odd place. So it's August 1994, and men are going missing specifically around the gay bars in Indianapolis, Indiana. So Mark Goodyear, that's what he went by in the documentary, was at a gay bar, and he found himself uncomfortable, a little bit uneasy, with someone he was talking to. And this person gave him very bad feelings, and he got this feeling from the stranger that he knew something about what was going on with these missing men. So Mark decides that he's going to go home with this peculiar man. And this peculiar man, who called himself Brian Smart at the time, said he was taking him to his employer's home in Hamilton County. And when they get there, all that Mark remembers is that there was a sign outside this big mansion estate that he can only remember the word farms on it. And this house is secluded. It's huge. And once they get inside, Mark is instantly... Mark is uneasy. He is scared because this house is littered with mannequins that are dressed up. These mannequins have different poses and they're in different positions all across the house. Specifically in the pool, these mannequins are lined up all the way around the pool. And when Mark asks Brian about these mannequins, his only response is the owner didn't want to feel alone. Okay? Now, at some point in the night, Brian starts insinuating, you know, what is he into in his private life? Wink, wink. And, you know, he's not feeling this conversation, but he is terrified, but he knows that from these strange, weird circumstances, Mark knows something is going on. He knows that this guy is mega shady, and he doesn't run, and he wants this information. And so the stranger, Brian, is like, how do you feel about, choking, being choked? And Mark is like, basically, his response is, I don't know. I'll try anything once. So Mark lets Brian, in quotes, put a hose around his neck. And it's not, he specifically says this wasn't assault. It didn't feel like assault. It was, you know, consensual. They both wanted it. And, you know, at first he said, you know, he liked it until, you know, Brian started to tighten it and tighten it and tighten it, and tighten it until he was scared. But, you know, Brian let go. He didn't kill him. He showed no signs of aggression per se, you know. And so Brian is like, yeah, you know, reciprocate, you can do it to me now. So Mark, you know, chokes Brian, and Brian goes unconscious, which I find this a little strange to me. Why would he make him go unconscious? That to me is just so strange. He goes unconscious in the pool. They're in the water. in the pool water. And he goes unconscious and, like, floats below the surface. And in the interview, Mark, like, wasn't alarmed. He was literally like, oh, wow, he might drown. And about a minute later, Brian comes up to the surface and is just jabbering and going on about the rush that he felt from that experience. And when he asks, like, when Mark is like, what about this makes, like, is so great? Like, why do you feel this way, particularly about this experience? And Brian tells him, what about it turns him on. He literally says, watching their eyes bulge out of their heads and the swelling of their lips as they, like, are desperate for air. And when it gets to the point where they're almost gonna die, when this person is almost going to be dead, the discoloration of the skin. And immediately, Mark is like, whoa, that's like when your lips start swelling and your eyes start bulging, that's like during a heavy, like when your airway is like completely, like there's no at all. You're like dying. You're not dead yet, but you are dying. You're on the brink of death. And it's so strange to me because that could have happened to Mark, like right then. And Mark is like, whoa, like this is hurting people. I'm going to tell someone because this is hurting people. And Brian just says, no one will believe you because of who you are. And, you know, by that he meant, like, you're a homosexual. Like, nobody's going to believe you in this extremely homophobic society. And Goodyear calls a private investigator about... he refers to him as the Strangler that's living in Hamilton County. And what we learn is that Mark's, I guess, experience helped break open this investigation towards these missing men in Indianapolis. What really is a shame about this whole situation with Mark is that the only thing he can remember is two things. Well, actually, no, it's three things. Brian Smart, the farms on the sign, in Hamilton County. That's all he has. That's all the information he has on this person. And we find out later through the investigation that there's no such person as Brian Smart. So the police are going off literally two things. A sign on a big mansion estate that just says farms on it. And it's located in Hamilton County. That's all we know. And the issue with this, the estate is it's secluded. You're not going to drive along a road and find it. You have to know where it is to find it. You have to know what it's called. You have to know the address. And they don't have any of that. But about a year later, after Mark's situation, he finds out that, well, he doesn't find out. He sees, in quotes, Brian Smart at one of the gay bars. And he asks his friend to follow him outside and write down his license plate number. So, with the license plate number, they went to police. And the car belonged to a Herbert Baumeister. So, Herb owned a Save-A-Lot thrift store. And so from the license plate, they now know that who... the shady guy from Mark's story is Herb. He lives in a big, giant, million-dollar estate called Fox Hollow Farms in Hamilton County. He has a wife named Julie and three sons. So, this is a guy who clearly has some information about what is going on with these missing men. And so the police go to the Save-A-Lot store and confront him. Now, immediately, the police know something ain't right about this guy. You know, the police, some people have a detector for people who are off. And they said that he was very on edge. Just them looking in his direction set him on edge, made him nervous. And that doesn't happen to somebody who's innocent, especially if they haven't done anything illegal. So clearly, this man had done something. And he denies ever being around gay bars. He has nothing to do with that. Until the police say, well, we have sightings of your car being down there, picking people up. And they're like, he's like, okay, your point, what does this have to do with me? And the police just say, is it okay if we take a look inside your house? And Herb refuses, point blank, no question. He says, no proof, no search. So basically, no warrant, no search. And this could just be, the police kind of say, well, maybe, you know, we have a hunch, like there's something wrong about this guy, but it could just be somebody who knows their rights. So they confronted Julie about it, and they go to the store, and they call her up front, and they said that they were investigating Herb on a homosexual suicide. And listen, I don't know what the heck a homosexual homicide is, but isn't it just like a normal homicide? And I don't know why they said that. I don't know if it's because it was a different time, people were a little bit more discriminatory outwardly, or they were trying to give Julie hints about her husband, because he was hanging out with these gay men, he was clearly sleeping with these gay men, and she had no idea, and she didn't believe police, because she was like, how is a man that has never yelled at me, who has never emotionally abused me, who has never physically harmed any of us, killing people? Okay. But the police had an inkling. They knew that something wasn't right. He was hiding something, small or big. They didn't know, but something was going on. So they don't have a warrant. They can't go inside the house. They can't step on the property. But what they can do is conduct a search from the air. So they conduct a search from a helicopter, and they used an infrared camera to detect the body heat from decomposing bodies. So this strategy isn't really useful if, you know, these people have been long dead. These corpses are like, they're now remains rather than corpses. And this wouldn't find remains, but it would possibly help them detect body heat if he was keeping these men alive. Because they hadn't found any bodies. They were just missing. And they weren't leaving of their own accord. And they couldn't find bodies. So maybe they were still alive. The police didn't know. So they don't find anything in the search, but this just makes the police more determined to find out what is going on. So there's some issues going on in the family. And in early 1995, Julie and Herb's son is playing outside in the backyard with his friend. And Julie's in the house. She's just going about her normal day. Her husband is out of town. He's not home. And her son comes to the back door with a human skull. And, you know, as any normal person, Julie is like, excuse me? Like, this is a human bone. Well, she didn't know it was a human bone, but it's pretty easy to tell what a human skull looks like. And Gina tells her sons, take it back, you know, don't touch it, just leave it alone. So when Herb gets home, she shows him the bones and is like, what is this? Like, can you explain, like, why this is in our backyard? And Herb just explains it away. It's not even a good excuse. It's literally this, I have, like, manipulated my wife to a point where, like, she'll believe anything that comes out of my mouth. He says that those were his father's anatomy skeletons. Because his father was a doctor. And Julie literally is like, okay, fine. She literally doesn't question it. And I don't know how you don't question a skeleton in your backyard, but it's just how it is, I guess. And she doesn't think anything else of it. Nothing happens. She doesn't think, you know, anything else of it. And it's really strange that she doesn't, like, think about what's going on. So, the business starts failing. And when the business starts failing and they're having problems, he's away, they just aren't, I guess, in quote, in love anymore. Like, according to her, that's how she felt. That she files for divorce. I think she files for divorce in January of 1996. And she told her attorney about her son finding the skull. And we're not really sure if she's filing for divorce because she's not totally, like, convinced that, you know, his crap excuse is an excuse. And so, you know, so her attorney is well aware of the investigation going on with her. Everybody is, especially, like, around them. They know that he's, like, a person of interest. There's something going on with this guy. And her attorney knows that this guy's under investigation for killing people. And her son has found, his own son has found bones, human bones, on his own property. But he can't tell the police because it's client confidentiality. So, everything goes on a standstill. Basically, there's nothing left to do until dun da da da. Herb disappears. Basically, he didn't completely disappear. He took their son to Lake Wawasee, and when Julie went to look at their money accounts, he had taken every single penny from the personal bank account out. There was nothing left. And now she's freaking out. She's literally like, okay, so my son, you know, so she calls her lawyer up, and the lawyer starts to, you know, be like, okay, well, we have to tell the police that he's taken your son and there's a dead body basically in his backyard. So the attorney sucks it up and he calls the lead detective on the case. And he says, you do not need to drop this lead because their son found a human skull in their backyard. This is what the police needed. This is what they needed to crack this case. They needed this so badly. This case was at a standstill. And the problem is they knew this was their guy. There was no questioning it. This was their guy. And the police sit down with Julie in her home. And they're like, we know about the skull. And Julie takes them to where her son found the bone. And the police find more than just a bone. No. There's more. There's teeth. And by the time that they, are done, they have found bone fragments everywhere in that area. And this is just looking. This isn't digging. And so the police are like, okay, well, there's definitely people buried here. Now we have to dig up this whole property, basically, because we have to find and identify these people. So, by the time they're done, they find a total of 11 skeletons. 11 bodies in the backyard. 11 bodies. Initially, there were 7, but now that there's 11, and 4 of them, and only 4 of them were identified. And this was only possible doing dental records because these people had been, like, dead for so long that they were just bone. So, it's out of their jurisdiction. Indianapolis cannot do anything. They can't arrest him because it's not in their jurisdiction. So they have to go to Hamilton County, and they're like, we found a bunch of bodies or remains in Herb Baumeister's backyard. We need an arrest warrant, or you have to do it for us. And Hamilton County refuses to help. They said that there was no proof that Herb killed these men, just because their remains were found on his property. And how crazy is that? This is bodies of missing men that were, like, these men were found in his backyard that he'd been hanging around the bars where they were taken from. And he also shows signs of having a fetish about strangling people. Like, this is, like, how do you not see this? Like, how are you not willing to help? And, well, it was, the main reason is because Herb was a distinguished person in their community. He was very successful. They're living in a million-dollar estate. So this guy is prominent. He has this good reputation of being good and being nice and never being mean and just being, like, this perfect homebody, perfect family man. And so they're like, well, there's no way that this person, this perfect upstanding citizen has done this, and we aren't going to, you know, tarnish his reputation based on this unsolid evidence. Okay. So, all of a sudden, Herb doesn't come home. He disappears, and they cannot find him. He's gone for days. Well, Mary gets a call. Not Mary. Who's Mary? Julie gets a call from her attorney. And he has been told by the police that Herb was found dead in Canada from a self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. And he left suicide notes addressed to his kids and his family and his wife. And not a single one of his letters or notes mentioned the bones or the murders. Which is basically like a giant screw you to police, because I would die before I, like, go to prison for what I've done. And I'm not gonna let you win. And it was very strange, because even after he died, this investigation was still ongoing. Like, it was, like, they still had to prove it was him. Like, it wasn't, they still have to find out who's done it. Basically, who done it, they have to figure out who's done it, because it's still an investigation whether or not that suspect is dead or not. And the media kept portraying him as this good businessman, and the media kept trying to say that basically, like, these men were, like, hanging out with the wrong people. Like, basically, they deserve to die because they were, some of them were drug addicts and prostitutes, and they've had all these crimes done. And it's like this, it's just this nasty, it's nasty. Like, this person, like, Herb had murdered 11 people just found in his backyard. Like, those are the bones just found in his backyard. And it's terrifying. It's terrifying. And they couldn't get anything from him. And not once during this entire time did Hamilton County help. And it's horrible. And, you know, when we get into why he's done this, like, why, like, when you, we have to find motive. Like, that's one of the things that the police were having problems with. Like, why is he just randomly killing people? Like, it's not, like, hate towards gay people, because he is gay. Like, it's, you know, like, it's not hateful. And from, you know, the theory is that, you know, Herb had an addiction to asphyxiation during sex, which is basically, you know, being choked. Or choking. I don't, it goes both ways. And initially, killing them wasn't intentional. He just, when you do that, you know, when you do something like that, each time it gets a little harder. You know, you have to do it a little harder, a little longer, a little tighter to make it better, to reach that high, essentially. And eventually, somebody died. He killed someone. And that is, like, the epitome of what asphyxiation will go. like killing someone, strangling someone. And after that, that was all that could get him off, was choking someone to death, basically. That's the theory. And that he intentionally, from that point on, continued to do it. And when you look up her Baumeister, you might find, like, the gay murders or the I-70 strangler. And he was never convicted of anything because he died. But he is suspected of killing around a dozen men on I-70, which is the road that connects Indianapolis to Columbus, Ohio. 12 men were found dead around that area. And each of them died of strangulation. And each of them came from the gay bar neighborhood in Indianapolis. Better yet, even crazier than that. So, let me flip my pages. So there was over 12 murders on I-70. All these men were gay and taken from the same area. They were all strangled. The craziest part, Herb and Julie and their family moved into the Fox Hollow Farms in 1992, a year after the I-70 murders stopped. But that same year that they moved into Fox Hollow, the men in his yard began to go missing. Another fun fact, as the bones were found by investigators, the remains got closer and closer to the back door of the house. So, if the theories are correct that he started killing these men on I-70 closer to Columbus, Ohio, and he got away with it. Like, when you look at this whole thing, this whole weird web of what he's done, he got away with it all. He didn't serve any time or punishment for what he'd done. And he was never convicted because he killed himself. So he lived on, going on about how he was getting away with all these things. And arrogantly and more confidently, he started to get a little sloppy. He kept it far away, but as he got more comfortable with killing, he moved closer and closer and closer to home. And that begs the question. We don't know to this day if he regrets it. We'll never know if he felt guilt. But from the fact that he didn't admit it, he died not admitting it. He died knowing that the world knew that he did it. But he still won because he killed dozens of people. And Mark, from the very beginning, remember Mark? The guy that basically just got him on the radar, said that during the times that they were talking, because they had multiple encounters just besides that one time to get information, that Baumeister insinuated that he had killed over 50 to 60 people. And even Mark himself says that, I believe him, without a doubt, that he had killed those people. And up until the time that he died, even past the time he died, people were still convinced that he was so perfect. That this monster couldn't be our friend or our dad or our husband, you know? But I think I wanted to start this with someone who really does prove that these monsters are among us.